The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning, and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We're so glad you are able to join us this morning. I'm the Reverend Larry Pierce, minister of this congregation, and on behalf of the congregation, I want to extend our welcome to you. Whether you are from far or near, whether from wherever you've come, wherever you may be on your life journey, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, however you identify or express your gender, whomever you love, whoever loves you, we welcome you this morning into this ever-expanding circle of love, compassion, and justice-seeking people. We have a place in our circle for you. So if you are visiting us for the first time or are new to us, you'll notice a link to a virtual connection card will appear in the chat. Please feel free to fill this out anytime during the service. If you'd like us to send you more information about Unitarian Universalism or about the activities of this congregation, welcome. So my opening words this morning, as we gather this morning to honor and to attune to the strength of the Spirit within and among us, may we open our heart to the wisdom in these words from Martha Beck. She writes, "If a problem looks difficult, relax. If it looks impossible, relax even more. Then begin encouraging small changes, putting just enough pressure on yourself to move one turtle step forward. Then rest, savor, celebrate. Then step again. You'll find that slow is fast, gentle is powerful, and stillness moves mountains." Since this is also Memorial Day weekend, I want to light this candle in honor of all of those who we owe our solemn thanks. We owe our solemn thanks to those who are injured and traumatized, who are on a path of healing, rehabilitation, or re-entry into life. We owe respect to those of all genders, a promise that we will never allow this nation to again go to war needlessly. We owe them a pledge to take the profit out of warfare, to guarantee that one person's loss is never the cause of another person's gain. We pause now to remember and to honor those who have sacrificed their lives, and we give them a solid gratitude and a solemn gratitude from our own hearts. We pledge ourselves, all of us, in their honor, to be peacemakers. Working for peace is what we owe these brave men and women. So may it be. Our guest preacher this morning is my Unitarian Universalist colleague, Reverend Megan Lloyd Joyner. I know you're going to enjoy her. Reverend Megan is a board-certified chaplain and serves as a compassion-centered spiritual health fellow at Winship Cancer Institute at Emory University in Atlanta. And she's an affiliated community minister at the UU Congregation of Atlanta. I first got to know Reverend Megan when she served as a parish minister for 8 years in Connecticut congregations. She moved to Atlanta with her husband and daughter in the summer of 2019, and the family welcomed a second daughter in April 2020, yes, during COVID. Reverend Megan Lloyd-Joyner had another commitment today, and so she's joining us in spirit and also on video this morning as she offers a reading, a meditation, and her sermon. Those who wish can join with me in the Soul Matters conversation in a breakout room today following the service to further reflect on Megan's message and our theme for this morning's story. And now David Drum will light our chalice.
I light the chalice this morning with words by Reverend Gary Kowalski, who is a Unitarian Universalist minister and author of many books. He has served in congregations in Vermont, Washington, Tennessee, Massachusetts, and New Mexico. Reverend Kowalski wrote, "With faith to face our challenges, with love that casts out fear, with hope to trust tomorrow, we accept this day as the gift it is, a reason for rejoicing."
And now Preston will light our peace lamp.
Oh, yes.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, "And with all the people of the world." May peace be with us and with all the people of the world.
Our gathering song this morning is entitled, "Just as Long as I Have Breath." Our worship committee chair, Jerry Lazaro, found this particular version, which I really love. It's being sung to us by the band at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Groton and Upton, and we've used some of their videos before. I want you to notice in the corner of the video, the Reverend Daniel Gregoire, my friend, he is another dancing Rev, and I'm just so glad to know I'm not the only one. So join in, the lyrics will appear on the screen. Let's sing, "Just as Long as I Have Breath." So My conversation through story this morning is entitled Grits. When I was knee-high to a grasshopper, I lived in New Orleans. And on some mornings for breakfast, I was given a big mug like this. And it was filled with warm milk and chicory coffee. Chicory coffee, if you don't know, is made of roasted chicory root. And instead of coffee beans, it's made from that root. And it tastes a lot like coffee. Now, accompanying the coffee for me would usually be a piece of French bread with butter, lots of butter, and which I would dip into coffee. And then I would eat and I would have some transitory moments of bliss to begin each day. Now, if I had been well-behaved or good, as they say, now some of you are probably asking now, Larry, when have you not been well-behaved or good? On those mornings, my mother would give me Nutella, a chocolate hazelnut spread that I would apply to the French bread. And then I would dip that into the coffee. And those moments were so blissful that I can't even find the words to convey this experience to you. Now, on some mornings, whether I had been well-behaved or not, I got scrambled eggs, toasted French bread, and grits for breakfast. Now, I love putting butter on the hot grits and watch it melt. And then I would add salt and pepper. And then I'd mix the scrambled eggs into the grits. And I do have words to convey that experience. It was delicious. People are very particular about their grits. Anyone on this room today really particular about their grits, how their grits are prepared? We're not going to open up that controversial topic this morning. But for me, grits have particular consistency and have butter, always have butter. So one day, I was leading a strategic planning process in a large Presbyterian church in Fort Worth and for the weekend. And at the end of the day, on the first night, I went to bed and I slept really well. I got up the next morning for breakfast and I went to the dining room. It was fancy. And the waitress asked me, "What do you want for breakfast, honey?" I looked at the menu and then I saw it, the word grits. "I'll have some scrambled eggs and some, well, how are your grits?" I asked her. "Oh, they're good." There's that word again, she replied. So breakfast came, I had scrambled eggs, more coffee than I probably should have had, and grits, which I loved. When the waitress came to pour me one more cup of coffee, I said, "You are right. The grits are good. I don't like watery, tasteless grits," I said to her. And she said, "Oh yes, honey. Our cook knows how to make grits. He's from New Orleans." It was then that she told me the story that she, the cook, and several of the workers on staff had moved to Fort Worth from New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. She shared the story of what it was like to leave everything behind, homes destroyed, family members perished or dispersed. And it was a tragic story, but also an inspiring story, reminding me of what it takes to move forward through uncertainty and to overcome obstacles. So in this morning's sermon from Reverend Megan, we're going to hear about grit, which the author of a book by that title defines as a combination of passion, a deep, enduring knowledge of what you want, and perseverance, hard work, and resilience. It's about moving in a direction with consistency and with endurance, like having a clear inner compass that guides your decisions and your actions. Now, when I look across this virtual room this morning, I know that there are many of us here that have that kind of grit. Sometimes out of necessity, we have developed that passion and that perseverance. This past year, it's a given. During this pandemic, we've had to combine whatever individual grit we have had in order to do ordinary things in extraordinary ways at an extraordinary time. This very virtual worship service is one example of our passion and our perseverance. We've had to stretch ourselves during this time, not be as insistent or particular as we may tend to be, but to recognize we are in a global pandemic and we can loosen up and lighten up a little bit. We have learned resiliency. We have practiced perseverance. So now I ask you, what do you think I call our collective, our group capacity for grit? You guessed it, grits. So when I ask you, do you got grits? Your response is, yes, we have grits. Ready? Do you have grits? Yes, we have grits. You sure do. Thank you. And now we'll move to our reading from Reverend Megan.
Our reading this morning is entitled Overcoming by Naima Penniman. This is the moment when we gather up our fallen angels and build a temple invincible. We've been hibernating below the surface of the world, growing roots, dreaming of sun, thirsting for rain. We sprout, crack, concrete, overcome the bullets and the toxic exhale of a machine built to kill. We rise like sunshine. The shadows are memory of the struggle it took to lift our heads above the drowning. We breathe, exhale this sky full of stars, pregnant with moon, trace the constellations in the shape of our revelation for tomorrow. This tomorrow has no name, but we are calling her forth. This tomorrow is not the same as yesterday, but she is as ancient as the world. We are ready for light. We are ready to live, ready to hold each other against the rim of existence. Cause they who built concrete against the corners of our hearts, they need to feel our resistance like a million tender blades of grass cracking sidewalks apart, reminding your runaway child that there is no place that love cannot find you. There is no place that love cannot find you. There is no place that love cannot find you. So ends the reading. There is no place that love cannot find you. With this truth in your heart, I invite you now to feel yourself grounded where you are, to feel yourself supported by the chair or the couch or the floor or the bed underneath you. Feel your feet firmly planted on the floor. Feel your hands resting gently on your legs or in your lap. Allow your spine to be erect but not rigid, and I invite you to take three deep breaths, deep belly breaths, all the way in through your nose, down through your torso, and filling the belly with blessed air. One, two, three. Now I invite you to let your breath return to its natural rhythm, in and out, and turn your attention to your breath, feeling it on your nostrils, feeling it in your chest, feeling it in your belly. And remind yourself again, there is no place that love cannot find you. I invite you to hold that love in your heart, in the center of your being now, as a warm, gentle light that warms you as you breathe in and out. Perhaps it pulsates, that warm, gentle light that resonates with love and care, compassion and comfort. And as you breathe in, I invite you to offer that compassion to yourself in this moment. And as you breathe out, I invite you to let it expand into the world, to offer that compassion to a world so in need of our care, so in need of the reminder that there is no place love cannot find us. Because each of us, all of us, have that love to offer, to share, to give. There is no place love cannot find you. You are invited to deepen your meditation now as you focus on the breath and that warm, radiant light. And we listen to the meditation music. To greet each other, how to be together, how to trust science and trust each other once again, and how, in the midst of all of this, to offer each other time and patience and grace in this time that my colleague, the Reverend Taryn Strauss, calls our emergence. We are beginning to finally have the mental, emotional, and spiritual space to reflect more deeply on our experience of the past 15 months. We have not completely turned the corner, we know that, but we are at least, Dr. Fauci said at the end of March, solidly at the corner. And perhaps by now we are peeking around it. I think you all are a little bit further around the corner than we are here in Georgia. In any case, at the corner is as good enough place as any to consider how we got here. And so I ask you to take a moment to reflect on what got you through the past year. What did you find you needed that surprised you? What did you find you had that surprised you? What emotional and spiritual tools did you either realize you had at the ready, or did you discover were missing from your toolbox? Each one of us has a pandemic story. And each of our stories, because each of our contexts is different. But the more folks I talk to, the more I discover that everyone seems to have something that we have done or something that has happened to us over the past year and a half that we would have never thought before that we would have been able to endure. I wish that we were physically together this morning so that I could hear your stories. Instead, let's make space to hold them in this sacred space for a moment. Let's take just a moment and perhaps another deep breath to honor where we have been and what we have done individually and together these many long months. As we begin to emerge here in the United States, and as we pray and fervently hope and work that others around the world might also begin to be safer, I have been thinking about how we have persevered, how we have survived this time. At times, it has felt like we got here through sheer grit. Throughout the pandemic, I have been seeking out authors and poets and researchers, writing and learning about the relationship between grit and resilience. And I've been thinking a lot about what kind of grit is required for our time, for this time. Dr. Angela Duckworth is an academic researcher and the founder and CEO of Character Lab, and she defines grit as passion and perseverance. It is, she says in her book on the subject, sustained persistence applied toward long-term achievement. Grit is sticking with your future, she says, day in and day out, not just for the week, not just for the month, but for years, and working really hard to make that future a reality. Grit is living life like it's a marathon, not a sprint. Well, these past 15 months have certainly been a marathon, and I would argue one for which we did not train. But we have run it diligently, dutifully, day in and day out, week in and week out, month in and month out. We are still running. We are sticking with our future. And our tomorrow will not be the same as yesterday, as the poet says, but nonetheless, we are calling her forth. In her research on grit, Duckworth has determined that those who excel at their goals, be they high school students or high-powered CEO or the best athletes on the planet, the things they have in common are a stick-to-itiveness that enables them to excel. As I said, she defines grit as that combination of passion, a deep commitment, and perseverance, a willingness to keep going despite obstacles. And if you add to that deliberate practice, she says, what she defines as purposeful and systematic practice aimed at improving performance, well, she says if you add those three things together, a person can achieve next to anything they set their gritty mind to. It really is next to anything, because no matter how gritty, how determined, how passionate we are, there are things beyond our control. Many of us have learned that all too well. And there are always things that we cannot achieve individually, only collectively. And in the end, we are only human after all. This morning, I would like to share with you a very human story that I discovered in my search for that essence of grit and resilience. It is the story of one of our Unitarian Universalist ancestors, David Starr Jordan, who, rather than being the model of grit we might have hoped he would be, he became instead a cautionary tale. One, however, that we can still learn from. Now, I will tell you that this is not an easy story. Jordan's version of grit led him down a destructive and a hateful path, and he hurt people. He hurt women, especially. I'm going to share just a small piece of some of the destruction that his ideas caused with you this morning. I truly believe that we can face hard and even ugly things when we face them together. But I promise you this, I will not leave you there in the hard and the ugly. Because ultimately, our quest is the same as the one that drove the author who unearthed David Starr Jordan's story. It's the same as the poets who, line by line, attempt to answer the question so many of us ask, in a world that is ruled by chaos, how are we to live? How are we to love? These have been the questions of the past 15 months, for sure. But are they not really the defining questions of our human existence? I think they are. And I believe that one of the unexpected blessings of this wild, wild time that we have lived through is that we have each learned some of our answer to those questions. Chaos. Journalist Lulu Miller writes in her book that came out last year, it's called Why Fish Don't Exist. Chaos, she says in it, is our ultimate enemy. Chaos will rot your plants and kill your dog and rust your bike, she writes. It will destroy your most precious moments, topple your favorite cities, wreck any sanctuary you can ever build. Chaos, she continues, will get the person you love most. It will crack them from the outside or unravel them from the inside with the mutiny of their very own cells. And chaos, Miller says, is the only sure thing in this world. Lulu Miller felt her own life being overtaken by chaos, and so she began her own quest for the secret of resilience. It was in doing so that she discovered the early 20th century taxonomist David Starr Jordan. Now, Jordan was an expert in fish. He was an ichthyologist. He and his crew would eventually discover and name a full fifth of the fish species known to date. Miller was especially struck by the story of Jordan and his fish collection and the fateful day in 1906 when the earth shook in San Francisco. Jordan's massive floor-to-ceiling collection of glass jars, each containing a fish specimen and a small tin tag with the name that he had given the creature. All of the jars came shattering down on the floor in the earthquake, and the tags and the fish were launched at random around the room. Miller writes about this beautifully. She says, in some terrible act of genesis in reverse, his thousands of meticulously named fish had transformed back into a heaping mass of the unknown. Jordan did not crumple in the face of chaos. Instead, he grabbed a needle and thread, and he began affixing the tin tags to the flesh of the fish that he recognized. And he did this for days, 3 days. His assistants rigged up hoses to control the decay, and Jordan rebuilt, renamed, and reorganized his collection. He quite literally held chaos at bay. Lulu Miller was intrigued. She was entranced. This was what she was looking for. And she set out to learn all there was to learn about Jordan's life. Now, Miller leaves out the fact that Jordan was raised a Universalist in upstate New York, and that later in life he declared no religious identity, and yet he changed his middle name to Star in honor of Thomas Starr King, who was a Western pioneer of our Unitarian Universalist faith. Jordan was close friends with Unitarians and Universalists across the country throughout his life. And his life is a tale of grit. His lab was destroyed by a lightning strike. He started again. After 10 years of marriage, his wife tragically died, and then his baby daughter. And he picked up and he moved forward, and he married again in short order, and he had more children, and a second child died, and he carried on. He became the founding president of Stanford University at the age of 40. And then there were the fish. Soon in Miller's quest to determine what secret quality Jordan possessed that enabled him to bounce back from devastation again and again, he became the anti-hero of his own story. There was the blackmail of a gay member of the Stanford faculty, the decades-long conflict with Jane Stanford, who disagreed with Jordan over the direction of the school that bore her name. There was Stanford's suspicious death and Jordan's swoop in to discredit the doctors who had determined that she had been poisoned. And even more abhorrent, most abhorrent, was his deep dedication to the eugenics movement. Because you see, David Starr Jordan extended his belief in taxonomy, the categorization of living things, from animals to humans. He believed there was a ladder built into nature, a divine hierarchy from bacteria to humans that points objectively towards better. And resilience and grit were part of that. He weaponized them. Jordan had no space for weakness or struggle or depression or despair, and that ladder provided for him a sense of natural order, which is, if we are honest, something that so many of us crave. The problem was he began to see increasingly himself and others like him at the top of the ladder, and the rest of humanity categorized as depraved. Now, as I said at the outset, Jordan's model of grit and resilience led to destruction and hate. This man who had been born into a family that believed that all people would ultimately be reconciled with God became a champion for a movement that advocated for the sterilization of those members of society they deemed unfit. Ah, David Starr Jordan, how profoundly you disappoint us. Now it would be easy here to avert our eyes, to damn Jordan and those like him, and declare ourselves immune to such heinous beliefs or actions. But if we dig a little deeper, I think we can see a truth that so often when human beings seek to hold chaos at bay, like Jordan did, that's when we lose sight of our core values and sometimes even the ability to calibrate our own moral compass. Indeed, I think that this is the same impulse, this impulse to reorder a chaotic world, that I believe has driven so much of the destruction and the hatred that we have seen of late here in our own nation and around the world. But back to the story. I promised I wouldn't leave you in the ugly, and I won't. Because like us, Lulu Miller, the author, she was disgusted by Jordan's moral turpitude and diligently continued her quest for meaning, her mission to discover the antidote to despair, the antithesis to chaos, to find some semblance of significance to our human existence. And that is how she found herself one day sitting across from one of the victims of Jordan's theories of superiority, a woman named Anna, who had been sterilized in a state institution. And it was there that she had befriended a younger woman named Mary, who had been brought to the institution as a child. And Mary and Anna loved each other deeply. They became companions for life. Miller interviewed them in the apartment that they shared as older ladies. She says that that day she spoke with them, she took in Anna and Mary's love for each other. The way they lifted each other up subtly in the conversation. They testified over and over to each other's inherent value. These women, that in large part based on the beliefs and teachings of men like David Starr Jordan, society said were not worthy, yet knew profoundly and instinctively that they were. Sitting there with them, Miller had a revelation. They were the significance, she realized. They were the antidote. Anna and Mary and everyone connected to them, those who loved them and those who they loved. This small web of people was keeping one another afloat, Miller writes, through minuscule interactions, like a friendly wave or the gift of a simple necklace of plastic beads strung up on a nylon cord. These simple things, she realized, they may not have looked like much from the outside, but for the people caught inside the web, they were everything, the very tethers that kept them bound to this planet. So I ask you this morning, what are the tethers that have kept you bound to this planet? Because I believe that the existential threats that we have faced in the past year and a half, and to some extent still face now, the existential threat of the coronavirus, the existential threat to the principles of democracy that have anchored this nation for hundreds of years, the existential threat of a failing economy, the existential threat faced on a daily basis by people of color in this country, all of these things have been something of a genesis in reverse. Because the truth is, the order that we have desperately imposed upon our world has literally come crashing down around us like David Starr Jordan's jars of fish. And in the face of chaos, we could have picked up a needle and thread. We could have reclassified our world and the people around us in an attempt to regain order, and indeed many have. But some of us have been even more gritty than that. We are more gritty when we choose instead to turn towards each other, to tie ourselves to each other, to others, to say to our fellow human beings, you matter and we are bound. We have been separated, but we have not been divided. We have chosen to find significance in each other. We have chosen to love. We have been bound together this year by a spirit of resilience that goes farther than simply gritting our teeth and holding on with white knuckles and grinning and bearing it. We have been bound together by our passion and our perseverance, and we are bound together now by our commitment to our collective future. The grit required for all of this is defined by grace and gentleness. Grit for our time requires not a brutal stoicism, but creativity and imagination. And as my 7-year-old daughter reminds me daily, it requires belly breaths. So as we begin to emerge, let us reflect on how we have found meaning in the face of chaos, on who we have been and how we have been during this time, how we have kept our center and stayed grounded, how we have summoned our inner grit to keep going one foot after another, day after day, week after week, month after month. And then let us expand our vision and ask ourselves, how have we made a difference in this time? How have we spread love? To whom have we offered compassion and gentleness and grace? To whom can we offer those things now? May we continue to be gentle with ourselves and with each other. May we remember to breathe. May we emerge now like green shoots through concrete. And may we remember that it is love that binds us together, and that there is no place that love cannot find us. May it be so.
Lots of questions that Reverend Megan offered us there. And if you want to join in a conversation, a Soul Matters conversation after the service, I'll be hosting that and we can hear from one another. This is the time in our service when we attend to the matters of our heart. This is a time where we recognize joys, even little joys that may have occurred to us or that we are anticipating. And we bring them into our heart and sometimes into our collective heart as a congregation. It's also a time when we recognize what sorrows we may be holding for ourselves, for those that we love, or for our world. We will have an opportunity to share these if you would like. And there will be a time where you can do that. You'll get instructions about sharing if you want after the musical interlude. I will begin this morning. Even before the musical interlude, to acknowledge the loss of Michael Strauss. Michael, as some of us know, was someone who shared his enormous gift of music in some of our worship services at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. But what he shared with us was only a small part of what he shared with the world in all the places that he shared his music in conservatories and symphonies. But also he had a particular dedication to the next generation of musicians and developed a way of teaching music, a whole brain method that allowed many to discover not only the capacities for music, but their own human capacities as well. Michael died in March. We didn't learn about it until this past week. And so let's take a moment together in our collective heart and remember Michael.
All right. Well, with that, I think we will bring this time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life. The words will appear on your screen.
I extinguish this chalice with the words of Albert Schweitzer and encourage all present to join me in unison in reciting. At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. And now the closing song with lyrics will be on the screen with song leader Christine Perry and accompanist Isaac Strader.
My life flows on in endless song above earth's lamentation. I hear the real, though far off, hymn that hails a new creation. Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear the music ringing. It sounds an echo in my soul. How can I keep from singing? What though the tempest round me roars? I know the truth, it liveth. What though the darkness round me close? Songs in the night it giveth. No storm can shake my inmost calm, while to that rock I'm clinging. Since love prevails in heaven and earth, how can I keep from singing? When tyrants tremble as they hear the bells of freedom ringing, when friends rejoice both far and near, how can